It's Audio Mode 2020, Day 25. One of the, I guess, added bonuses of working with Bletchley Park is the number of really amazing people I meet. Authors, professors, historians, but for me, most of all, it's the veterans. Now, one person I met originally in 2012 was a lady called Eileen Younghusband. Now, she wasn't actually a Bletchley Park veteran. She was a WAF officer during World War II, and she worked in the filter room. So when you've seen films of World War II and Battle of Britain, you see the girls, as they would have called themselves, they still call themselves girls now, the veterans I speak to, around a plotting table pushing counters with the incoming German planes. But Eileen wasn't one of those. Eileen was actually a filter officer. So she was taking that information from them, taking the information from coastal watchers, from radio detection, from radar stations, and she'd have to collate all that information. Now, I met Eileen because she came to Bletchley Park at one of our reunions and gave a talk about what she'd done during the war. And we struck up a friendship from that day onwards. I knew Eileen for 4 years. She unfortunately passed away in 2016. About a year after I met Eileen in 2013, I was asked by someone to go and record Eileen. It was going to be for a series of interviews that were going to be done on a group of Great Britons. It was a project being run out of the Cabinet Office when David Cameron was the Prime Minister. Unfortunately, it never came off. It fell through, and it was months before I was told that it wasn't happening. And I basically had to tell Eileen, you know, after having told her that this was going to be this massive thing, that it wasn't going to happen. And she wasn't upset. She was disappointed, you know. But I promised her then that, you know, these would hear the light of day. And I have actually used some of these recordings in some of the Bletchley Park episodes, because some of the things that happened to Eileen during the war directly link to stories that we've told in our It Happened Here episodes. So what I've decided to do is take that original interview, which was about an hour and a quarter, and I'm splitting it up into sort of listenable chunks for people, because I realise people have busy lives, and I'm going to put these out over the next 5 days. I ask you, do listen to them, because this lady had an amazing life, and she was just such an inspiration. You'll hear a lot of things that I think you'll be really surprised by. And you'll laugh, and you may cry. I don't know. She can be very, very poignant, but she can also be very, very funny. So you'll hear very little from me for the next 5 days, just an introduction for each of these. But all of this is in memory of an amazingly inspiring woman and a friend, Eileen Younghusband. So from this first part, we go from Eileen being at school all the way through to joining the WAF. And in between, we have her being in France in 1938 during the Munich crisis.
No problems, only solutions is my motto. I started yesterday when I was telling somebody. I said I was very fortunate that I went to a grammar school, Southgate County School in North London, with a very forward-thinking headmaster. And the first thing he said to us after we got our scholarship and went there, I'm cutting out the first form. You will take matric when you are 15 years of age, so I have 1 year in which to begin your education. And so in the last year, leaving school when I was 16, I had already done a year of commercial training with shorthand up to 150 words a minute, bookkeeping and accountancy up to balance sheet, which is something that's been so useful for the rest of my life, economics, commercial French, commercial German, and I was 16 in the July as I left school 2 weeks after I'd got my matriculation results. Well, I was good at mathematics. This was the most important thing that I knew was a good trading thing. And since I was interested in business anyhow, that's why I chose to study commerce. I quite liked art. Although I learnt to play the piano, I wasn't really a musician. and not really a scientist. It was my brother who was the scientist. My brother ended up at Jet Propulsion Laboratories working for NASA, and he designed all the space instruments that landed on the moon with the surveyors. And Voyager, that's just gone out into the solar system, he had two of the instruments on that. So he was the scientist and I was a mathematician. Because I inherited that from my mother. My mother worked in a counting house. A counting house is the old-fashioned name for the accounts department. And that's where the mathematics came from. Within 3 weeks of leaving school, I had a job right in the heart of London, opposite the Bank of England, next door to the Mansion House, near the Royal Exchange at No. 3 Lombard Street. And I was going into an insurance office to use my maths abilities. And it was quite interesting because as soon as I got there, I realised the difference in the way men were treated or males were treated and females. The young men who, of the same age as me, arrived in beautiful suits with their new ties. I arrived suitably dressed, but they put me in a mauve, scratchy overall. And I realised that a woman was never going to get as far in those years as a man would. So it in a way coloured my image of life in the city. And so when a few months later, the language master from my old school decided to set up the school travel service, which was almost the beginning of sending school children to stay with families in France and Germany to increase their foreign knowledge of a language, he wrote to me and said, "Eileen, you're very good at languages. Would you come and work for me? You must first work in France and then in Germany and polish up your languages so that they're absolutely perfect. And then I will use you to go out and plan the trips for future school journeys." And I was keen on it by then. And my parents trusted me and they straight away said, "Go for it." I suppose my genes must have bred me being intrepid. That's all I can say. It was 1938. I was 16 then. And he said to me, "You must find somewhere where you can do an au pair job." An au pair in those days was teaching children to speak English, not cleaning or anything like that as it is more now. And so we looked in the magazine, The Lady, and we found that someone was asking for someone to teach their three children English. And I wrote, I got the necessary testimonials from the headmaster and the Baptist minister, because I was a Sunday school teacher in those days. And I got a reply saying they would love me to go over there. What I did not know until I received the letter confirming that I would be accepted was that I was going to work for a Monsieur Marcel Boucher. He was a député, a member of the Chambre des députés, a French member of parliament. He was the representative for the Vosges Mountains, based in Contrexéville, which was a spa town. He'd been the mayor there for many, many years and then graduated to become their representative in the French Parliament. And so in May 1938, I set sail for France and took a train via Paris and landed up at Contrexéville. I was met by the wife in a very smart car, taken to a large house in beautiful wooded grounds, and I met the three young children, Hélène, Jean, and François, that were going to be my charges. And I used to give them an hour's lesson every morning in English. And then in the afternoon, once they'd finished their other lessons, because they had private tutors for all the other things, French and German and mathematics, I used to take them out into the fields and teach them English games like hide and seek. And Robin Hood we used to play. And, all sorts of things. And then in the evenings, I lived as family. I used to sit at the dining room table when we had wonderful French cuisine. And I used my French then all the time. And I was there and met all the incredible people that would be invited. And I was still treated as much as family as anyone could be. I met the then Prime Minister of Romania, who eventually was found out to be a supporter of communism. But in the August, Marcel Boucher, who was rather like a territorial, was sent to do his, I thought, his yearly couple of weeks at camp. And he was sent onto the borders of the river at Strasbourg. And he'd been there two or three days, and a phone call came through to his wife, and she summoned me. And I wondered what had happened. I was brought in the office. I thought, what have I done wrong? But she said, Eileen, you have to go home immediately. But I said, why? Well, she said, my husband tells me the Germans have moved in the demilitarized zone on the other side of the river, and the river is mined, and he is certain war is imminent. And of course, it was 1938, and it was the Munich crisis. So the next morning, I was taken to the railway station. I made my way alone to Paris, had to find somewhere to stay for the night. I talked to a gendarme, and he found me a little room in a convent for the night, and then I got the train the next morning. And I'll never forget that train journey, because the carriages were stacked with people, and they were talking, I thought, in German. But no, it wasn't German. It was Yiddish. And these were German families who'd managed to escape from Germany. And they got fear all over their faces. And yet, as we got nearer the coast and they knew that they were going to get to Britain and to safety, the fear drained away. They opened their baggage, things wrapped up in old curtains and everything, brought out all their jewellery, put on their brooches and their rings and started smiling. And that's when I really grew up and began to know that life was not all honey. Well, coming back to Britain, I had to find myself a job again. But the Scottish Provident that I work for asked me to go back. And by then, they were evacuated to Woking because the war started very soon afterwards. And I found myself in Woking at the time of the Dunkirk disaster, virtually, a disaster which turned it almost into a victory. And because I was much younger than the rest of the personnel that were working there, I joined the YMCA in order to help in the canteens. And when the troops in the nearby barracks had a bit of entertainment or wanted extra meals. But when Dunkirk happened, we were asked to man the railway stations because all the troops, as they were brought back to the ports of the South Coast, there were so many of them, there was no time or facilities to feed them all. The wounded were sent to hospital, but the others were put on trains and sent to the very first big railway station en route. There, they got off the train and there was always a big canteen for feeding them with sandwiches, coffee, tea, cakes. And Woking was one of the first stations. And we did that for however many days of the Dunkirk evacuation. On the third day, an incredible coincidence happened. Earlier on, when I was a child, about 14, I was having music lessons. And my music teacher used to have foreign students over, and we were asked to entertain them. And I met a young man called René Cadier, who lived in Po. And we were quite friendly for 14 days, and then he left, and that was the end of it. But on the third day of the evacuation, as the train drew in, as usual, the doors opened and the men came out, mostly in khaki, some in RAF uniform, blooded, without their weapons, drawn, tired and hungry. And they'd come to the table. They had a quarter of an hour with us. They grabbed a sandwich and had to be back in the train within that 15 minutes. And on this third day, almost opposite me, a door opened and someone came out and I noticed there were pilot's wings on his left-hand side. And his uniform was not the Air Force blue, it was more grey. And then I realised that it was probably the French Air Force. And as he opened the door, his face changed and a smile came on his face. He came straight to me and said, "Mon Dieu, c'est Eileen." And this was René Cadier. It was the most incredible connection. And of course, I looked after him. I gave him an extra lot of sandwiches. I tore a bit off the paper cloth and wrote my address and details on and said, "Keep in touch." And a quarter of an hour later, he disappeared. I thought that would be the last I'd ever hear of him. But many, many years later, travelling through Po, I looked in the telephone directory, found his name and knocked on the door. My husband and I met him very briefly. He by then was a pilot with Air France and a well-known pilot. He himself has written a book, but he died within the last 6 months. He has got quite a history because he was dropped back in France, apparently, by the Royal Air Force, and I suppose to help the RAF pilots that were escaping to get over the borders, because he was in the Pyrenees area and knew all the routes over the mountains. So that was an interesting little incident, or big incident, in my life. I'd seen the Jewish faces with fear. Then I saw the faces of these soldiers who'd escaped but gone through trials. We don't know how many days they'd been on the march or what terrible things they'd seen before. But you could see etched on their faces experiences that very few people ever have to go through. Very soon after that, the Battle of Britain was happening, and my father was in the Royal Flying Corps in the First War, and my cousin Eric, who was my favourite cousin, was a pilot, had been killed. And I thought, well, I've got to do something more than this and be evacuated working for an insurance company. So I volunteered for the Women's Auxiliary Air Force late in 1940. There were many people offering their services, so it wasn't till January, February of 41 that I got my interview up in London. And the day before I went up to London, I met someone who was at school with me. We both were rivals in the 100 yards race, because I was a sprinter in those days. And this young lady's name was Mary True, and she was in a WAF uniform. And I said, "Gosh, you look smart. Hope I look like that. I'm going up to be interviewed for joining tomorrow." She said, "Eileen, can I give you some advice? They will say to you, do you want to be a cook or a driver? And you say no and say, I want to be a clerk, special duties." I said, "What's that?" She said, "I can't tell you, but just tell them you're good at mathematics." So I said, "Okay." And this is exactly what happened. A very substantial WAF officer, I think she was a wing officer, sat there and I was sitting in front of her. And she said, "Right, do you want to be a cook or a driver?" And I said, "No, I want to be a clerk, special duties." I thought she was going to hit the ceiling. "How do you know about that?" I said, "Well, I don't. But a friend of mine's one. And she said, I had to tell you I was good at mathematics." It was the magic word. Clerk, special duties, she wrote down. And that's how my life evolved in the Air Force. And I got to do a job with wonderful women, a job that was fascinating, a job that was so important that none of us realised at the time, but was the linchpin of the defence of Britain, because it was part of Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding's Dowding system of defence, which is filtering all the radar information that came from all the sources, turning it into aircraft tracks, identifying it as friend or foe, giving height, direction, number of aircraft, and identifying it. And we would pass that information over to the girls that you see on television with the rods, the plotters in the operations room. We would give the air raid warnings. We would tell the air-sea rescue if any of our aircraft crashed into the channel. We would hand over the information as the aircraft passed over the coast to the Observer Corps, because radar didn't work sufficiently well in the initial stages. because of the clutter or ground race caused by buildings. And Churchill, in one of his books, mentions the filter room, and he says, "The wonderful efforts of the Spitfires and the Hurricanes were incredible, but all their efforts would have been fruitless without the Dowding system." And the Dowding system had a pivotal point, and that pivotal point was the filter room, and that was the centre of the heart of the defence of Britain. It was, as I say, the linchpin of the defence of Britain. And I had the privilege of working with these women.